First, I'd like to welcome all the veterans to the committee today. I understand you're here being part of the legislative process, and we certainly welcome you to the committee today as we deal with a number of important issues for veterans. And I think we're going to start with Senator Scogan's bill, Senate File 2632. Senator Scogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Senator Scogan, just I'll mention to everybody, I see there's a pretty full agenda. A lot of the authors are committee members. But I would ask, because today we do have a half hour less committee time than we normally would have, if we could keep our testimony as brief as possible, but make sure that we get the important details that you're trying to transmit to the committee. Senator Scogan.
75.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, today we take up Senate File 2632. A day to honor Vietnam Veterans Day, March 29th. It was March 29th, 1975, committee, that the United States of America officially exited the Vietnam conflict, or the conflict in Southeast Asia. Vietnam veterans, as you know, part of our testimony today, we'll talk about June 28th, 1967, when 150 young men and women were sworn in just before a Minnesota Twins game at Met Stadium. They went into the Marine Corps. Over the next 8 years, almost 60,000 men and women died serving this country. Answering the call of duty and honor, they served for us and for each other. Times were different in America back then. These veterans came home for the most part alone. There were no parades, caravans, standing ovations, and potluck appreciation dinners. Marking March 29th as Vietnam Veterans Day does not offer closure. That comes personally for each veteran. It does mark the calendar, giving Minnesotans a specific day to honor those that served us at this time, and lets this band of brothers and sisters hold clearly one day a year. We have testimony today from two people, and I will let them introduce themselves. One has a personal story to share with about a Vietnam veteran. The other is the author of the book, The Twins Platoon, the group of men and women that was actually inducted that night at Met Stadium. Mr. Chair, I turn you over to one of our presenters today, Diane Finneman.
Ms. Finneman, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
They do need your name.
My name is Diane Finneman. I'm from Forest Lake, Minnesota. And I represent just one of the thousands of families of Vietnam veterans who lost their loved one to suicide caused from post-traumatic stress disorder. My brother, Private First Class Wallace R. Schmidt, is a Silver Star war hero. He returned from Vietnam wounded and disabled, only to find a hostile, unfriendly society. His pride quickly turned to worthlessness, anger, and guilt. And like others, he struggled in anger and solitude with what to believe in and how to fit into an unwelcome society. Tragically, my brother, Skip, lost his battle with post-traumatic stress disorder in 1972. It's my hope that March 29th will be a catalyst that will promote the education and the truth about the Vietnam War. Vietnam veterans were never officially welcomed home nor given the respect and gratitude that they deserved. And the Vietnam veterans are the only American veterans who were ridiculed and spit at for serving their country and risking their lives for freedom. I don't ever want people to forget these soldiers. And by making this day and honoring this day of March 29th, it will give one more opportunity for us to remember these veterans and to teach the truth about the war. Thank you.
And Ms. Vinneman, my and the committee's sympathies are with you.
Mr. Chair, also today, Christy Sorrow, who is the author of The Twins Platoon.
Mr. Sorrow.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Christy Sorrow, Jr., and I'm the author of The Twins Platoon. This is why I support having a Vietnam Veterans Day. It will increase public awareness. The more Americans know about the true cost of our freedom, the better. Recognizing Vietnam veterans will help to further educate our citizens. It will provide a platform for education. It paves the way for educators to talk about a wide variety of important subjects, such as the Vietnam War and how to support our people who serve in the military. It will provide an opportunity to re-educate people. For years, the Vietnam War was referred to as a conflict and not a war. As author of The Twins Platoon, I was shocked to learn how little people knew about the Vietnam War and its veterans. It will provide recognition. Positive recognition for our veterans is a must. And I believe it will increase patriotism. Knowing how our veterans have served our country will make Americans proud. It did for me. Growing up, I heard all about World War II. And knowing what those veterans did for our country made me proud to be an American. It will provide a stepping stone. As a nation, we celebrate Veterans Day. It's a national holiday. And as a veteran, that day is very special to me because I know what it represents. But what about our future generations? For Veterans Day to really be meaningful to non-veterans, they need to know about our wars and the people who fought in them. Making March 29th Vietnam Veterans Day provides a stepping stone. I believe it's a step in the right direction. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators.
Thank you, Mr. Sorrow.
Mr. Chair and Committee, thank you for hearing the testimony today, and I ask you to please consider making March 29th Vietnam Veterans Day. We would stand for questions.
Questions or comments, members? Well, thank you very much, testifiers and Senator Scogin. You know, as individual who went through school in the 60s and 70s and looked back at World War II, and as a young person, I thought that was a long time ago. But for my children now, as they go through their schooling, it's longer in number of years for them back to the Vietnam War, and I think that this is a very good initiative to try to bring attention to the Vietnam War and the sacrifices that were made. Senator Scogin, do you have a motion on Senate File 2632?
Mr. Chair, Committee, I would move that Senate File 2632 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Thank you, Senator Scogin. Senator Scogin moves Senate File 2632 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Consent calendar.
Move to the consent calendar. Is that okay with the committee?
Yep.
This will be sent to the consent calendar if it prevails. Anybody else in the audience that would like to testify on this? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevailed. Bill's passed. Thank you, Senator Scogin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Koch. Senator Koch, welcome to the Ag and Veterans Committee. You have Senate File 3055.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. Thanks for having us. Mr. Chair, this is a veterans initiative coming from the governor's office. It's a portion of the governor's package. And this portion deals with sort of to eliminate, reduce economic injury to small businesses that either employ reservists or folks deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan. There's sort of three pieces, so I'll start at the top. The first section deals with no interest loans to small businesses. These are five employees or less who have some experience with economic injury because of deployment of either their owner or a key employee. And members should know that this section does have some money attached to it. The second section puts anyone who's been deployed into the dislocated workers fund. So there's not money required from the general fund from that. But it would put them in with, we have dislocated workers for, last year we did for employees that were hurt by the smoking ban. We have homemakers in the dislocated workers fund. This would include folks that are returning from deployment and put them in the dislocated workers fund. And then the third section provides a UI benefit employee pool. This would be within the unemployment benefits, and what it would do is it would provide a little pool for companies that have someone who is activated, sent overseas. They employ a temporary person for that deployment time, and then when the reservist comes back, they have someone that goes on unemployment, and this would just reduce a little of that effect on the company. It would be sort of a pool that would kind of reduce that. So I've got Charles Schaefer here with me. Oh, I'm sorry. I misspoke. Just so you know, the small business in Section 1 would be 20 or fewer employees. 20 or fewer, not 5. I misspoke there. Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment that maybe you want to put on before.
Senator Cook, is this the first stop for this bill?
This is the first stop. We're in business and jobs tomorrow.
Senator Coring moves your amendment. Senator Koch, there's a small technical change that we're going to incorporate in your A1 amendment. Mr. Bodern?
Mr. Chairman and members, if you look on the language in the bill that this amendment would change, which is on page 3, clause 6 there, the amendment is adding language that says the discharge has to be within the last 36 months. So that would make part of the language you see on lines, page 3, lines 9 and 10, duplicative, or, you know, it's in effect rendered unnecessary by the changes in the amendment. So what you would do on page 3, line 9, delete everything after the comma, and on page 3, line 10, delete everything before has and insert and. So then the new language would read, is a veteran as defined by section 197.447 and has been discharged or released from active duty under honorable conditions within the last 36 months, et cetera. So that would work without being unnecessarily duplicative.
Senator Coring incorporates that within his motion. This is the first stop, so it's an author's amendment. All right. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment's adopted.
Okay. Mr. Chair, would you like to hear from Mr. Schaefer?
Mr. Schaefer, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Charles Schaefer from the Small Business Assistance Office at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The Senator has done an excellent job of summarizing the three major points of this bill. I just want to say, with regard to the first part, the loan part, that this parallels a federal program operated by the U.S. Small Business Administration, and we expect that anyone who applies for that would also apply for this in Minnesota. Our applicability, however, is much broader than the federal one. The federal one is limited to reservists and National Guard people who have been deployed under Title 10 of the United States Code, effectively called to federal service. As defined in the bill, ours would be available to Title 10 deployees, to people deployed under Title 32, which is federally funded state service, as, for example, in the case of the National Guard taking over security roles at the airport, and is also available for reservists who were deployed in state service. So it's a much broader availability than the federal one is. With regard to the second piece on the displaced worker program, the intent of the amendment, as you see, that the Senator put forth today is to make that program very available, or more broadly available than it might otherwise be. As originally proposed, this was limited to returning reservists who had acquired new skills in their service and were therefore underemployed. What we've done is we've made this services available to all returning reservists. So everybody who returns gets the services of the dislocated worker program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Members, let the record show that we have a quorum, and nobody questioned Senate File 2632, which we voted on, so that vote will stand. Okay. Questions, members? Senator Koch, there's a couple of committee stops for you. It looks like you do have rulemaking in here, so I think it'll have to go to state and local. But business, industry, and jobs has also requested this. So I think we'll send it to business, industry, and jobs first, and then if state and local wants it, they can request for it from there. Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, I just was going to make that motion that I move that we recommend the bill be passed and referred to the jobs and local government.
As amended. Senator Hamm moves that Senate File number 3055 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee. Any more discussion? Anyone in the audience wish to testify on Senate File 3055? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's passed. Thank you, Senator Koch.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Yeah, is there anybody else here? No. Senator Erickson Ropes, Senator Vickerman is not here today, and you're kind enough to pick up Senate File 3264 for him. So, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Mr. Chair, I'm not seeing our sign-in log down here. Do we have that?
Senator Erickson Ropes will check.
In the meantime, Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about Senator Vickerman and my bill. This is a great new opportunity that will be starting in Minnesota, and I was just talking to the gentleman that I'll speak to you in a minute in the hallway before we came in, saying this new program is attracting some national interest. So just to let you know, Minnesota is going to be laying out an opportunity for veterans that has not happened anywhere else before, and I think this is going to be a terrific opportunity to put Minnesota on the map for veterans again. The bill that I have before you is Senate File 3264, and this establishes a new apprenticeship program, and essentially it's an educational bridge. Every year there's about 800 military-trained medics that are discharged from the service and come back to Minnesota. And some of you sit in healthcare committees, and we know that we have this healthcare worker crisis in Minnesota. So we have this opportunity to retrain medics that are just coming out of the service and create an educational bridging program so that we can get them into civilian sector jobs. And in this particular bill, we're looking at ambulance services. And I'm from the rural area, and we have a critical shortage of ambulance volunteers out there. And additionally, I think the metro area is struggling with recruitment and retention as well. So what we're proposing is to pull together a committee of people that would look at the certification requirements in the state of Minnesota and the training that the medics are lacking. Like one example would be OBGYN. They don't have a chance in the service very often, especially if they're a combat medic, to perform and become proficient in OB events. There would be a few additional training opportunities to run the medics through. Then they would come out on the other end of this fast-paced, fast-tracked program, ready to land with their feet on the ground and qualify for some of those civilian jobs that are out there, and there's a huge demand. So with that, a little bit of an introduction, I would like to have O.J. Doyle, who is here with the Minnesota Ambulance Association. It's their group that has been studying this and brought the bill. So I will turn it over to OJ to run you through some of the specifics.
Mr. Doyle.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is OJ Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I was also a paramedic for 15 years. This is in my roughly 25 years of lobbying on behalf of emergency medical services. This is quite literally probably the most exciting enterprise that I've ever been involved in. What we're doing is we are taking experienced combat medics coming back from the service, and we're putting them in a program that we're in the process, and part of this funding is going to be used to design to create a bridge program to fill in the areas of additional training for them so that they will be able to move into a civilian job working in emergency medical services. We're looking at it long-term as a phased-in program, but once we get the initial plan, comprehensive plan, the roadmap, if you will, established, next will be then the training. Then beyond that, how can we create initiatives for these individuals to move to areas where we are facing tremendous shortages of emergency medical services providers? In my 15 years as a paramedic, I didn't have the number of serious trauma calls that these individuals have in 15 days. This is an extraordinary resource. And also, I think we owe these folks something. They've contributed a great deal to our country and to our state. Many of them are interested in staying in emergency medical services, and this long-term project will be a means of retaining them and also encouraging them to move forward and address shortages of personnel in other parts of the state. The Senator put it, we've been talking about this for a number of months and working with a couple of state agencies and veterans groups very informally, but the word has gotten out. We've had calls from Senator Klobuchar's office. She held a press conference even in Thief River Falls on this. In fact, there's so much interest and momentum, it's ahead of us. And that's part of what we're trying to do with this allocation is to be able to formalize and kind of bottle the enthusiasm and get it pointed in the proper direction. Right now, this is the only program, even in the talking stages, even in the country. And again, Minnesota will be the vanguard for this, and we're incredibly excited about it. And we have a lot of people who are willing to volunteer their time to help make this a successful program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Mr. McAlpin, you...
Mr. Chair and members, just to be brief, from the Ambulance Association, Buck McAlpin, president of the Minnesota Ambulance Association, we've worked pretty hard the last 6 months since, I believe, Gary Cornerbaum from Department of Labor and Deed from the Workforce Center brought this to us initially, saying he's receiving calls about medics coming back and there was no apprenticeship program. Through the Department of Labor, we found out they had the apprenticeship program packaged, but these are usually ran through trade associations like the MAA is. We're a large association, obviously all volunteer. That's why we asked for some of the funding stuff. OJ and I felt it wasn't the right year to ask for money, but when we look at what we could do with this program, we thought maybe we should go forward with it. In the apprenticeship program, the larger providers that have been working on this, Alina, North Memorial, Health East, Gold Cross, St. Paul Fire, Hennepin County, and some of our even rural smaller services have already anteed up what's called apprenticeship positions where we'll offer our combat medics gainful employments with health benefits once they enter the program with Inverhill, Century College, MinSCU, or any of the paramedic programs as we move forward. As OJ and Senator Robes said, very exciting program for us to work on.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Just another point to add on to this is one can just get one's mind going here once we think about trying to transition our veterans as a workforce coming back to Minnesota, not only moving the medics into emergency management positions, but we could also look at how we're going to link them to firefighter opportunities or first responder opportunities, or beyond the medical field, and I've already talked to, and I forget his name, I'm sorry. Jim Finley with the department earlier today about sitting down with some people and doing a much broader assessment about all the MOSs that are coming back and seeing where we need to do some more educational bridging. So if somebody's coming back with computer technology skills, are they lined up with the civilian certificate qualifications or requirements? Or let's look at all the different MOSs and see where we are in terms of, are there gaps between what Minnesota requires for certification or moving into different occupations, and see what we can do to bridge those gaps. Because right now there's a lot of people coming back that have exceptional skill sets, and we want to make sure that they have an opportunity to really move smoothly into the Minnesota workforce. So I think this could really put us on a track for doing some really exciting things, not only for the ambulance services, but for many other volunteer and occupational opportunities.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, too, this is a wonderful opportunity, I think, to capture the expertise that's coming out of the military. You know, Minnesota hasn't been very good, actually, for folks coming out of the service, especially for those that are retired and moving forward with a couple of good initiatives this year, including the tax reduction, I think is a wonderful idea. Also, coming from the area of the sector of business that I come from, this OBGYN training would be very, very helpful for those first responders, which I did not have myself and had to respond to several of those myself. So understanding that, it would be a great, great opportunity. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
You bring up a good point. You know, many of us know that you're, I have a sheriff's history. But there's a lot of people that are in law enforcement in the military that might also, if we look at that as an occupational sector, be able to look at some of the bridging opportunities available to move people from who are MPs into our police force and into our sheriff's departments. And just the more you think about it, the more opportunity there is here. I think I'm pretty excited about this.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to say a word in support of this bill, too. It does seem to me that, I spent my time in the military working with a fairly broad array of military-trained medical personnel, and it does seem to me that they don't have the same constraints on their scope of practice that we have a tendency to put on similar folks in civilian life. Primarily, I suppose, because they spend a lot of time in the field with our troops so that if their attention is needed, it can be given at that point. So I think it's a very good idea to use the skill sets that are gained in the military, like Senator Erickson-Ropes says, that we can put them to use and give them some employment in the civilian sector that pays them enough to live on using some of the skills that they gain there that are probably going to be above and beyond what we actually allow, people of similar training to utilize within the civilian setting. But, even though I worked in conjunction with a lot of medically trained personnel within the military, I was eventually assigned to the School of Aerospace Medicine's Research Division. But, I have had enough contact with these folks that I think most of them are very good people, and they know their craft pretty well. And I think that it's an excellent idea to try and utilize some of those, particularly in rural areas where we don't have the people trained in these capacities that might otherwise be there in a metro area.
Senator Wergen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of wish Senator Vickerman could be here because he's such a champion for the vets, and I think this is a good bill. And Senator Erickson-Ropes, my son's an MP, so let's go.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions, members? Senator Erickson-Ropes, this bill needs to go to the Finance Committee.
Okay.
So Senator Erickson-Ropes moves that Senate File 3264 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. Anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 3264? Sure. Welcome to the committee and state your name.
Welcome, Mr. Record. Chairman and the committee. My name is Marvin Garby, Montevideo, Minnesota. I'm also the Chippewa County Emergency Management Director and serve on the Southwest Emergency Medical Services Board, and we strongly endorse this Senate bill of Senator Vickerman's. There's a shortage of ambulance personnel out in Southwest Minnesota, and it's just another way to get those people into the program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Garvey. Senator Erickson Ropes renews her motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill's passed. Thank you, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, members.
Senator Coring.
Okay.
Senator Coring.
Oh, thank you, Mr.
Korean
Chairman.
War Veterans Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as you have Senate File 3443 in front of you, it's pretty similar to the bill that Senator Scogin had. It's naming July 27th of each year is designated as Korean War Veterans Day in Minnesota. I have a gentleman here that's a Korean War veteran, and I asked him, I don't even know his name, so, but I asked him to come up here and say something, because...
Well, I'd just like to say, Mr.
Welcome
Chairman...
Welcome to the committee, and would you please state your name for the record?
My name is Frank Cruz, and I want to say thank you for letting me speak. The time has come, and... I come from a small neighborhood that all the young men were drafted during the Korean War. And anybody that ever walked them was one another when they come back. And I think it's time that the rest of the state recognizes it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coring.
Thank you. Thank you for that very much.
I should stop there because
really nothing else needs to be said. But I want to tell you a story of what happened to me. Right after I got elected in 2003, I had some local folks. In 2003, it was the 50th anniversary of the Korean War, the Korean conflict. And, you know, I have Camp Ripley in my district. And so, you know, veterans are, well, obviously veterans are a big deal all over, but it's really important to us up in our neck of the woods. And there were some medallions that were made up on the 50th anniversary of the Korean War, and those medallions were going to be handed out to Korean War veterans at Camp Ripley. And so the commander at Camp Ripley called me up and said, would you come down? We'd like to have you present these medallions. And so I went down there. I'd only been in office a few months, and I got to tell you, that was one of the most emotional days I've ever had, because when these veterans came up and I presented this medallion and placed it over their head, there wasn't a dry eye in the room, I can tell you that. But then a couple months went by, and my uncle, my dad's brother, died. And my dad had two brothers in Washington State and two brothers in California, and they all came back for the funeral. And my dad is a Korean War veteran. And my dad's brother, George, is a Korean War veteran, and they came back for the funeral. We went out to dinner the night before the funeral, and I was telling my Uncle George about these medallions, and I was telling him how emotional it was and how it was just a great honor for me to present these. And he says, boy, he says, I sure would have liked to have gotten one of those. So I went home, and I don't think I called Commander Bill Rooley, but I called somebody, and I was able to get one of these medallions. And so after the funeral, the next day, we had the lunch, and then I asked everybody to come back up in the church, because I told them I had an announcement to make. And I had that medallion in my hand, and I had the ribbon wrapped around my finger, and everybody's sitting there waiting to see what the announcement was, and I told them I decided to go into the priesthood. But, and I said, no, I'm just kidding.
I asked George Coring, my uncle, to step forward, and I said, you know, George, I said, I know you haven't lived in Minnesota for 40 years, I said, but you're still a Minnesota boy, you serve this country. And I said, on behalf of the citizens of Minnesota, we'd like to present you with this medallion. And I presented him with this medallion. And his chest was way out there. He was it was a big deal. And so that was in the afternoon. That evening, Uncle George, he was staying at my dad's, and he was downstairs, and he was laying on the floor, and he hollered for my dad, went down, and I don't know if the ambulance guys are here, but the ambulance came and took him into the hospital, and he had an aneurysm, and it broke. And they were wheeling him into the operating room, and he told his wife, he says, I don't think I'm going to make it. And she says, oh, you're going to be just fine. He says, I love you. And he says, take care of my medal. And we wheeled him in, and he died on the operating table. And so that medallion, I can tell you from personal experience, that means a hell of a lot to veterans, and this day is going to mean a heck of a lot, too. So I think that this is important to recognize our veterans, and so I would ask the committee's support on this, and appreciate your attention.
Senator Coring, any questions, members? Motion, Senator Coring?
Yep. I would so move that Senate File 3443 be recommended to pass. And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have that placed on the consent calendar if that would be okay with the committee.
I think that'll be fine, Senator Coring. Anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 3443? Seeing none, Senator Coring renews his motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's passed. Thank you, Senator Coring.
Thank you.
Senator Kubley, would it be timely to do your medallion bill?
Sorry.
Yeah, very good.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2750, as many of you know, some of you were down here at the Capitol for the Veterans Memorial being, I don't know what they did, was commemorated or dedicated that day for those who fought during the Second World War. I agree with Senator Coring that, this is a small thing that we can do for our veterans. I hope it isn't the only way we say thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a personal word of thanks means a lot to our veterans, and I wish we could, be a little more verbal in expressing our thanks in that regard. But, Mr. Garvey is with me here today from the Montevideo post of the Legion, and this is actually his idea. There were just a certain number of these medallions that were minted, but I think Mr. Garvey has a suggestion that might do away with the fiscal note, and maybe if we'd been allowed to pass the hat after Senator Coring's presentation, we could have raised it here in the room. I don't know, but I'd like to have Mr. Garvey say a few words to the committee, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, again, my name is Marvin Garvey. I'm Commander, American Legion Post 59, Montevideo, Minnesota. First, I've been down here so much. Is there a way I can qualify for per diem?
Sure. Mr. Garber, we'll run that by the rules.
Okay. 326,000 Minnesotans served during World War II. There were 6,000 casualties. It is estimated there are about 4,000 still living in Minnesota. On June 9, 2007, I, along with 50-plus veterans, attended a dedication of World War II Memorial in front of the state capitol. 20 of these were World War II veterans. American Legion Post 59 chartered the bus to ensure that those that may never be able to see the memorial have the opportunity. We took along five wheelchairs besides so we could move some of these about. Although this was a long trip from Montevideo, leaving at 9 a.m. and not getting home again until 6 p.m., these veterans thoroughly appreciated the opportunity to attend the dedication ceremony. My American Legion Post 59 was able, through assistance from American Legion Department of Minnesota, to purchase an additional 52 medallions to present to our members who could not attend. The oldest veteran was 94 years young. Commissioner Dyrud from the Department of Veterans Affairs was present and presented the medallions. He praised these veterans for service to their country and for the contributions they made and are still making to society. It took too long for Minnesota to remember these brave service members, both men and women, for the service they rendered to their state and nation. The cost of providing medallions to the remaining service members would be small based on the number in attendance and those presented by various service organizations. And somebody must have a figure how many were presented at the dedication. I'd estimate it was close to 1,000. And various service organizations were able to get some before Johnston's cut off the manufacture of them, which I think was premature for Minnesota Company. I could have taken more time, but what else can you say? We do not have much time left to bestow this small token of appreciation on these men and women. We will be providing military honors again tomorrow for one of these heroic individuals back home in Montevideo. Thank you, God bless America, and God bless Minnesota.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Garvey and Senator Kubley. I think this is a very good initiative. And I have to tell you, I don't remember the year, if it was 99 or 2000, but the Minnesota legislature passed a law that we would provide high school diplomas to World War II vets that were not able to receive their diploma because of their service. And Senator Moe, I was the House member at that time. We were part of two of these ceremonies, and it was really quite a moving action for these veterans. But I did have to say that it was one of the few times I was part of a graduation where we didn't have to wonder what the graduates were going to do with the rest of their lives. But a very, very, very commendable initiative. Senator Kubley, did you say something about amendment to deal with?
Well, I don't have an amendment drafted, but I know Mr. Garvey had talked about his own Legion post buying the medallions for the members of their post that were not able to make the trip down here. So, you know, I don't know if that would be a possibility across the state or if we could do something like that where we contact each of the posts and inquire about that possibility. Or, you know, it just seems to me it's a small token that the posts would be willing to take part in, and it would also do away with a fiscal note, but I don't have an amendment prepared at this time, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Kubley, and you won't have a deadline issue with the finance, so we certainly can handle that when it comes back to the Finance Committee. So any questions, members? Anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on the Senate File 2750? Seeing none, Senator Kubley, this needs to go to the Finance Committee.
All right, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 2750 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Any more discussion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's passed. Thank you, Senator Kubley. Thank you, Mr. Garvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate your time.
Didn't address the per diem issue.
Well, they're just going to deduct that per diem, I think.
Can we start Jim's bill?
Taurus Ray.
Well, let's see. Senator Lori, we have a bill on the agenda that you are a co-author on.
Okay.
And we were wondering if you'd be willing to present Senate Senator Pretner Solon's Bill 3450. We do have somebody from the department here to help you.
Sure.
So, Senator Laurie, if you would help us out with Senate File 3450. Oh, here's Senator Torres Ray. Let's move to Senator Torres Ray, and we'll see how this goes. Walked in very timely, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I was just downstairs in the Transportation Committee, so thank you for giving me the opportunity to present this bill. And this is a bill that originated in the House, and I am happy to support the House member that introduced this. And Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 3006 is a bill that will authorize a memorial plaque that will be placed in the Court of Honor on the Capitol grounds by Minnesotans, Mexican-American veterans, to recognize the services of all Minnesota veterans who have served in our nation. Before I move, I understand that there was an effort to have a more inclusive process so that other veterans are included in this particular plaque. And in the House, there was an amendment that was introduced and to make the language consistent with the language that was that passed in the House, I need to introduce the A1 amendment. I would like to propose the A1 amendment.
Senator, there's additional comment? Okay. Senator Torres Ray, is this the first committee stop for this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, so we'll do this as an author's amendment. Mr. Bodern, would you walk us through the A2 amendment, please?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to explain to Senator Torres Ray that this is actually the A2 and not the A1. It contains a couple of additional changes just to keep it to conform with the language that was agreed upon on the House side.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Torres Ray, should we have Mr. Bodern tell us what the amendment does exactly, if you would, please?
Mr. Chairman and members, I think the main differences you'll see in the amendment, obviously it's got a purpose statement, and it's naming both the legislator and Minnesota's Mexican-American veterans. But the big difference is in Section 2, you'll see that the plaque will recognize the service of all Minnesota veterans as opposed to limiting that to Mexican-American veterans.
Thank you, Mr. Bodern. Senator Laurie will move the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Torres Ray, you have some testifiers, Mr. Puglisi, Mr. Medina.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Medina is here. And I also have Mr. Mandel in my.
Hi.
Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Puglisi, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I wasn't expecting to testify, but we have worked with the CAP Board and with the authors, both in the House and Senate. And I believe the language that has been brought forward has been agreed upon by all parties. The Department of Veterans Affairs, we support it. We think it's a good compromise.
Thank you, Mr. Puglisi. Questions, members? Mr. Medina and Mr. Mandel, please. Whoever would choose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Michael Medina. I'm adjutant for AMVETS, American Veterans, Post 5 in St. Paul, Minnesota. I chair the Mexican-American Veterans Memorial Committee. I served with Naval Construction Battalion 40 in Chulai, Vietnam from 1967 to 1968. I am a member of the Fighting 40 Veterans Group. I am a member of the CB Era and a member of the Navy CB Veterans of America, Island X2, Minnesota. I am a graduate of the University of Minnesota, and I am a registered architect in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to testify for the plaque and the Mexican-American Post 5 has been in existence for 6 years, started by a couple of East Side friends, Ray Rangel and Chuck Aguirre. Our post, and I have tons of things that we do for the community, but some of them are just food donation. We participate with the ROTC. We raised $4,000 for Gladys Radius, who was hit, was the hit and run girl in West St. Paul. We donate to time to the Veterans Hospital, and we have five members who are military rifle squad at Fort Snelling. Why we want the plaque for the Mexican-American veterans in the state capitol grounds, there's been a lot of talk about not excluding anybody when we were writing this or going through this process. Our post wants to talk about being included. It's about telling our story. And Hollywood hasn't helped us any. It's documented that Latinos have served this country since the beginning, since its beginning. It's estimated that 500,000 U.S.-born Latinos and immigrants fought in World War II. During World War II, 11 Mexican-Americans and 2 Puerto Ricans were recipients of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Ken Burns, in the 7-part series of World War II, never mentions the Latino contribution, nor after much protest, he would not change his film. And his film did not include the contributions of Latinos, women, African Americans, or Native Americans. Guy Aldan, a Mexican orphaned, reared by Japanese foster parents in California, served in the Pacific, was a war hero who spoke fluent Japanese, and he helped coax 600 Japanese to surrender. A movie was made of his act, bravery. They couldn't get John Wayne, so they asked Jeffrey Hunter to play the role. There are many documented stories of exclusions. Our community here in Minnesota has served this country since World War I, such as Manuel Hernandez Huerta, who served in the Army from February 26, 1918, to December 1918. In World War II, St. Paul had a population of 600 Mexicans, and in 1937, that grew to 2,500, and to 3,000 in 1946. In one neighborhood, a small community known as the West Side Flats, it's an area approximately 12 blocks wide, 12 blocks long, lived immigrants from all over the world. Mexican, Jewish, Lebanese, Native Americans, Africans, and a few Irish. During that period of World War II, our Mexican community lost Pedro Medellin, George Silva, Tina Verdeja, killed in action. Simon Velasquez was a prisoner of war in Stalag 17 and was freed after the Germans surrendered. Dave Chiapas is a survivor of the Bataan March. Rudy Zamora never came home. He's still missing in action. Where is their sacrifice and service recognized? I can give you a long list of names of our Mexican Minnesota veterans that served in Korea, Vietnam, Somalia, to our present war. This May, there will be a street in St. Paul's East Side that will be named after the Gary family, who had 11 brothers who served in the military since World War II. State Representative Willie Dominguez had 8 brothers from Minneapolis that served in this country. Since then, our communities in St. Paul, Minneapolis, and out-of-state Minnesota has grown, and our service in this country has grown proportionately. Yet, we seem to be excluded. We are Minnesota's invisible veterans. I am a proud Minnesotan. My story is like many of my fellow veterans. I am a grateful child of Minnesota destiny. I didn't ask to be here, yet I'm filled with gratitude. Please remember, we are all sons and daughters of immigrants. My father is a World War II veteran and the oldest member of our post and is an active member. He still participates in all our activities, including marching and parades. He's 93 years old. When the Second War began, my father was undocumented with a wife and three kids and was drafted. He said he was honored to serve. He said he felt guilty because many of his friends had volunteered or were drafted before him. He was with MacArthur's 8th Army waiting to invade Japan when the war ended. And as a result of his service, he was awarded his citizenship. He constantly states that that he is proud of his service to this country. What did this country give us? It gave us opportunity. After the war, many of these veterans took advantage of their education from the GI Bill. They became homeowners. They were able to better their lives for themselves and their families and the community. In conclusion, why is this plaque so important? It is to show our gratitude. Most of all, is to be included. Our Mexican veterans, most members are proud Minnesotans, and want to be recognized for their service. We want to acknowledge the efforts of those veterans who served, that contributed to this country, those who gave, and those who gave all, as stated in the Korean War Memorial. I want to thank you for allowing me to share a small glimpse of the Mexican Americans of our state of Minnesota, who have served with distinction and some with their lives, and to tell the story of AMVETS, Mexican-American Veterans, Post 5, St. Paul, Minnesota, and to express our need to be included. I'd like to recognize our Post 5, 10. Flip the flag. 2. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Medina, for your testimony and your efforts in service. And thank you, members of Post 5. Questions, members? Mr. Mandel?
Mr. Chair, Paul Mandel, Principal Planner for the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. And as Assistant Commissioner Puglisi mentioned, the language requires that the Veterans Affairs and CAP Board are consulted on the language. The language that you see before you in the A2 amendment is the form. My understanding is that it will be presented on the House floor because an identical bill went through two hearings over the House with three different language changes, trying to be all inclusive and respectful of everyone. Each time it ran into trouble and difficulty because of its lack of inclusiveness and its singling out and the fact that we have 13 plaques out on the Court of Honor right now. We have two that have already been authorized and not yet installed, and we only have 9 spots left. So we didn't want to get into a situation where we start recognizing each group by themselves because we quickly run out of space. We don't have anything yet to either Gulf One or the current conflicts in Afghanistan or Iraq. So working with the House author and others, and Mr. Medina, we came to this language, and this way it starts off nice in the Senate, nice and clean and all-inclusive, so that we won't have the same problems we had on the House side. And my understanding, again, is that this would be a delete all amendment on the House floor so that the bills would be identical.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel. Any questions, members? Senator Torres Ray, do you have anybody else that you would like to bring forward?
No, Mr. Chairman, these are all the members that I have
Thank
here
you.
To testify.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate File 3006?
I may. Thank you.
Come on up to the table and welcome,
Chairman.
Welcome to the committee and state your name for the
Thank
record,
you.
Please.
My name is Raymond J. Rangel. I was born in the state of Minnesota. Years ago, over 75 now. As we heard from the gentleman that wrote the book, the concern was about the future citizens and their lack of knowledge. As we know now, very little is made about history. And I think it's important that the people know at least the history of their country. I'd just like to share a few things here. I've learned a lot and come in contact with a lot of the public, And some of the things we heard when we were at Harriet Islands, Mayor Kelly was in office and we had the parades down there, there was as many as 100,000 people around in and around Harriet Island. And when they saw us march, because we were as a unit, all Mexican-Americans, and I want to state that we have other than Mexican-Americans in our group, and one of them is here, Colonel David Larson, and we have two other officers, Lieutenant Colonel. He's in Virginia, Gary, and Lieutenant Colonel Henry Capice. But getting back to the story, we'd hear such things as, we didn't know Mexicans were in the service. We didn't know they had served. And we'd look at each other, and I guess maybe it's because we weren't segregated like the African Americans during World War II. We were just thrown in with everybody. But some of the comments that I want to share with you that we know from history, and most of it is not out. General MacArthur said during the big wars in the Pacific, he said, and as I quote, "Send me some more Mexicans and we'll win this war in 6 months." And it goes on like that. And I think it's very important to preserve this history. One of our organization, his main goal is to gather, preserve, and share all this information of sacrifices and lives cut short, plans unfulfilled, dreams never, they only remain dreams. One of the other things that our organization does, American Veterans is accepts women on the same level as veterans, not as auxiliary or as the girls that make coffee in the back room. They're on the same level with us. And we're very proud of this. One of our, we have two on active duty, Master Sergeant Eloise Walbridge, and we have Amanda Preciado, who's a sergeant, staff sergeant, and she has over 20 years service. And she has a sister who's a captain and another one that's a major in the United States Army. With us today, we have former Marine Rosemary Campos, who is a presently a teacher in St. Paul. I just want to read just a few real little short items in this book. This book also contains 41 names of Hispanics that have won, I'm sorry, that have been awarded the Congressional Medal of Honors, 41. But this goes back to 1776. I think we've heard the famous directive, "Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead." It was issued by Admiral David Farragut, commander of the Union forces in the Battle of Mobile in Alabama on August 5, 1864. According to a note in the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations, torpedoes means mines. Farragut, perhaps the Civil War's best-known Hispanic, was a son of Jorge Farragut, a Spaniard born in Spain. He also fought against the British in the American Revolution. A neighborhood street in Silva, Illinois, is named after a very special Latino community. It is called Hero Street, in honor of the 22 Latino families who live in a 1.5-block-long street. Together, they have sent over 100 men to 3 wars. During the Vietnam conflict, approximately 80,000 Hispanics served in the American military. Although Latinos made up about 4.5% of the U.S. population at the time, they incurred more than 19% of the casualties. Another one is Marine PFC Guy Gabaldon from East Los Angeles, single-handedly captured over 1,000 enemy soldiers in the summer of 1944. Another one you'll never hear about. Is it important? It should be for history. During the 1861 and 1865 Civil War, almost 10,000 Mexican-Americans, mainly from California, Texas, Alabama, Missouri, and Nuevo Mexico, served in the Army in the regular Army or volunteer units. Another one. Navy Lieutenant Everett Alvarez was the first American POW taken in Vietnam. He remained confined for more than 8 years, making him the longest confined prisoner of war in American history. Another first. And it goes on and on. Just to update you on a new one, the first woman ever, Hispanic or otherwise, to command the Marine Corps in San Diego was Brigadier General Angela Salinas. And she says of herself, she's a Brigadier General, you know all those big, she didn't say this, but this is the way it was written, you know all those big burly guys who sign up to be Marines? Well, many of them will soon be reporting to a 5'1" Latina during their grueling 13-week boot camp. Angie, a 53, a Brigadier General, is the only woman ever, Hispanic or otherwise, to command the Marines recruiting depot in San Diego, one of only two United States Marine recruiting centers, and is also the first Latina to ever reach that rank. She took her position in August after a long, distinguished career that began in 1974 and earned her dozens of medals and decorations. She says, I've tried to prove that I am not a good woman Marine, a good short Marine, or a good Hispanic Marine. The Mexican-American soldier says, I am just a good Marine. Now, there's something worth saluting. So that's just a few of the items. And the other thing we're proud of, that our duty and responsibility to our country, our city, and the neighborhoods we live in did not end with our honorable discharge. We are still a fabric of that, and many of us serve two or three different offices in different organizations. And with that, I want to thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'd just like to thank the two gentlemen that provided testimony just now. Very touching, interesting testimony with a lot of interesting historical facts that I did not know. And I want to thank you for your service, not only during your time in the armed services, but your service since then to help make our community a better place. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dill. Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate File 3006, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. Any more discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevail. Bill's passed. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. It was really an honor for me to be here with Mr. Rangel and Mr. Medina, and I really appreciate your support in honoring our Mexican-American veterans. So thank you for your vote.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Pretner Solon. Welcome to the committee, Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm here to present Senate File 3450. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs approached me with this bill in hopes of constructing a state veterans cemetery near Duluth. Presently, veterans in this region must travel 140 miles to the nearest veterans cemetery with available grave space. The department estimates that there are more than 46,000 veterans that reside within 75 miles of their projected site that are not currently served by an available open veterans cemetery. One of the major performance goals of the National Cemetery Administration is to work to provide a burial option within 75 miles of 90% of all veterans in the country. Establishment of this cemetery will increase the percentage of veterans residing within 75 miles of a burial option. Additionally, the Department of Veterans Affairs estimates that 14,000 veterans will die over the next 10 years in counties located within 75 miles of this site. It is estimated that 25% of those veterans will seek burial in our new state cemetery. Also, one family member for every two veterans will seek burial in the cemetery. These computations yield a total of 5,250 eligible persons seeking burial over the next 10 years, or 525 eligible persons per year. The state of Minnesota will not have a requirement of residency for burial. Therefore, the cemetery will also serve the veterans of northwestern Wisconsin. The estimated demographics of this summary include 12 counties in Minnesota and 8 counties in Wisconsin. The result of having a veteran cemetery in this location will extend the honor of burial in a veteran cemetery to significant numbers of people in northeastern Minnesota and northwestern Wisconsin who do not now have acceptable access to this earned benefit. And with me today is Christine Keel from the department, who can answer any questions that you might have. I might mention that the governor did have a press conference today. There is language in a DNR lands bill that is transferring land over for this cemetery.
Thank you. Ms. Keel.
Members of the committee and Mr. Chair, again for the record, Christine Keel, Department of Veterans Affairs. The bill as it's written, the only thing this bill does, there is no funding element to this bill. It just changes the language in state statute from cemetery to cemeteries.
Senator Cordy.
Somebody ended up as any money in that permanent trust account that they're depleting.
Ms. Keel, there's a question about, is there any money in that trust account, the permanent trust account?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. Could
on
you repeat
page
that?
Two, mm-hmm. Line 4 through 9, looks like we're eliminating the permanent trust account. Wondering if there's, okay, could you clarify what we're doing?
And yes, Ms. Mr. Chair. Keel. There is no money in the trust account at this time.
There's no money in it.
No money in it.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Cornyn.
Well, Mr. Chairman and committee, as you know, I have, I've told everybody time and time again, I have Camp Ripley, but I also have the Minnesota State Veterans Cemetery right on the Mississippi River, which just started, I think it's been 15 years now, somewhere in that neighborhood. I will tell you that there is so much pride with our veterans with having a local cemetery before the only place was Fort Snelling. And so now that we have a veteran cemetery, and I would encourage anybody that's never been to the one in Little Falls, it is a beautiful, beautiful cemetery. And they are extremely busy. As Mr. Chairman, as you know, I have a funeral car service, and I've had the honor to drive a lot of veterans to their final resting spot in this beautiful cemetery. So I think this is a great idea to have a cemetery up in Duluth. It's just another way that we can honor our men and women who have served this country very ably.
And Senator Coring, I understand that the land is going to be in the Jay Cook State Park, so it should be a very nice place.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I do have a question on that. You know, I heard, and I don't know where I heard this, but my question would be, and maybe somebody can answer this, there's not going to be a requirement for a sticker or anything to, no?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Knopf.
The language that Senator Pretner Solon mentioned that was put in the lands bill yesterday, as soon as this land is transferred over from the DNR, it will not be part of the state park anymore. So okay. there definitely will be no sticker requirements or anything like that, because it will not be it is being removed from the boundary of the state park. Okay. That was the language that was adopted yesterday.
Very good.
And Ms. Keel, another question on page 1, lines 18 through 24. I see there was some earnings from the trust account, and now there's going to be plot or interment allowance claims. Is there some financial implications to that the Finance Committee might need to know about?
Mr. Chair, we don't believe so at this time. The plot or allowance interment claims go back into the care and maintenance of the cemetery, I believe. I'm looking at my finance person. It goes back
Ms.
into
Keel.
The care of the, excuse me, Mr. Chair, it goes back into the care in the cemetery. It's reimbursement from the federal government. so for the proper care and maintenance of the grounds.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd just like to speak in support of this provision and tell a little bit about the location where this is located in Jay Cook State Park, just a little bit southwest of Duluth. It's actually in my district. It is right off of the Veterans Evergreen Memorial Drive on Highway 23. And actually, if you are taking that drive to Duluth, which I highly recommend, there is also an overlook over a huge valley of the St. Louis River that is absolutely breathtaking, again, on Highway 23. It's a veterans overlook dedicated to veterans. You'll often find flowers and notes there for the loved ones. And I haven't been there since I found out exactly where this parcel is. I think you can probably see this parcel from this breathtaking veterans overlook. I've actually left notes myself at this overlook for loved ones. And so it's a beautiful area that should be well suited to the needs of our local veterans.
Thank you, Senator Lori. And Senator Lori, would you like to move this bill for
Absolutely.
Senator Solon? Senator Lori moves that Senate File 3450 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. Any discussions, members? Anybody in the audience that wants to testify on the Senate File? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's passed. Thank you, Senator Mr. Chair. Senator Erickson Ropes.
I'm not on this one.
I think she's close. Senator Erickson Ropes, Senate File 3277. Well, we've got your two bills is all that's left. So.
Mr. Chair, committee members.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you very much. I apologize for being out in the hall. We've had a family death in our family yesterday, and families called back and forth and details.
We understand you have family concerns, so we're Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you. I have a bill before you today, and it's talking about a wound care approach that would be real helpful for the veterans in the veterans home. And earlier today, just to lay this out a little bit, I've had a chance to talk with people who work at AHS, which is Advanced Healing Systems, and they're going to do a little presentation for you on a wound care treatment approach that is, it's just got some pretty astounding results, you know, for long-term care patients with decubitus ulcers, bed sores, burns, long-term skin breakdown problems that have not responded in conventional treatments. And they have some pretty dramatic results. And we're looking at this as a possible intervention to fund through the Veterans Home system. And in talking earlier this morning with our new Assistant Commissioner Acevedo, I think he's here today around the corner, and Assistant Commissioner Puglisi and Christine Keel, they have some interest in keeping a conversation going about this approach. We're not We need to do some work on some of the language, whether there's a three-year proposal project or the funding mechanism for this piece, and you'll hear about some of that here. And then as to whether or not we want to start this program at the Minneapolis Veterans Home, because they, as you know, have their hands full right now trying to gain their balance and make sure that they're complying with all federal violations and regulations. So there's a need to have a continuing conversation, and I'm interested at this point in presenting this bill to you just more for information. If you want to act on that, it's up to you. I do want to hear from the commissioner about his thoughts about moving forward, but it seems to be a great opportunity to look at this intervention. So I, with that, saying that, I will present the Robert Pittner, who's with Advanced Healing Systems. And we also have here Kathy King, a registered nurse who's a director of nursing, and also Mary Hafner, who's a RN and working in quality assurance, to present this to this committee as a really good solution for some of the wound interventions in the veterans home system.
And Mr. Pittner first, or Ms. Hafner?
Yes.
Mr. Pittner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Pittner. I'm Chief Operating Officer of Advanced Healing System, a Bloomington, Minnesota company that provides products, technologies, services, and process to prevent and heal wounds through a very innovative wound care formulary system. Our innovative wound care formula approach is being used in long-term care, both nursing homes and transitional care units, as well as outpatient clinics currently. I am here today to ask you to support Senate File 3277. We have used some posters today. In the interest of time, let me direct you to the poster to my left. Since October 2005, Advanced Healing System and several Minnesota LTC, long-term care providers from urban and rural settings, have worked to develop and implement a formulary system for wound prevention and wound cure that is achieving remarkable and measurable wound resolution outcomes that are empirically documented via our web-based wound data reporting system and at significantly reduced cost. This program was guided in every case by the medical director, the administrator, and the director of nursing. Let me direct you to slide 2. This one. The wound prevention and care formulary program that is easy to train, easy to replicate, and incorporates the following coordinated and interdependent processes and technologies. The elements are provider training in standard protocols, new diagnostic and treatment technologies, which we'll address in just a minute, wound data tracking, web-based wound data tracking and reporting software, which empirically shows weekly the outcomes and the progress towards cure, and wound care guidelines that are consistent with the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel and the American Medical Directors Association. The wound prevention formulary, the wound prevention and care formulary program, is being expanded to 54 long-term care facilities this year through a pay-for-performance program funded by the Department of Health. The program is also currently being used in Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Florida, and Illinois. To date, over 600 Minnesota patients have been treated using our wound formulary with an efficacy rate greater than 95%. This represents a cure. 9 scheduled amputations have been prevented and healed in the last 18 months at a cost of the procedure alone of $140,000 to $150,000 per amputation. I'll point you to poster 3.
Mr. Chairman, can I just stop him for a second?
Senator Cornyn.
Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, the cost of, let's say I had a wound on my foot, the amputation, you're saying the amputation would be about $140,000. Is that correct?
That is correct, for the procedure alone.
For Mr. Pittner, Senator Cornyn.
Chairman, and that's just for the procedure alone, members, and where if this machine can heal that wound, that would save $140,000 right there.
Minimum.
And I was going to wait until you were done. I'll just come and say it quick, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for letting me have this opportunity to say something. But, you know, as I've served 6 years in the Health and Human Services Committee, we're, as you know, Senator Berglund is moving a bill through that we are trying to find ways to save money. Here it is right here before us. And I know that I would rather have my leg saved and not have it amputated. And if you're a fiscal conservative and you're looking to save money, here's your way to save money. And I would just say also that this committee is I think, charged with the responsibility of deciding whether this is good policy for our veterans. And I will say this is very good policy for our veterans. So I'm sorry I interrupted. It's just that I get so excited about this. I've known about this for over a year. And I'm going to say something else, too, when you complete. Thank you, and sorry.
I think I'll give you my chair.
Yeah.
Well, Senator Cornyn and Senator Erickson-Ropes, this bill is going to be, if passed, referred to finance, and it'll go from there toward Senator Berglund's Health and Human Services Committee. So you'll have an opportunity there. One other thing, as I mentioned at the beginning of the committee, we do have a shortened committee time today. We do need to be done by 5.
Okay.
We have one more bill to hear. So, Mr. Pittner.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, cost savings. Several long-term care homes are reporting major reductions in costs beyond procedures in the areas of wound vac use diminishing, outside consultants not being needed, wound clinic visits decreasing, and dressing and labor within the facility is decreasing, in some cases by 50%, and this is documented. One of the components of our formulary is a technology called pulse electromagnetic field therapy. This is a remarkable technology that sends pulsed radio frequency waves, very narrow band, into the wound to start fibroblast cell stimulation, and it triggers over 900 genes that are responsible for growth factors, proteins, and so on for proper body healing. A second technology that we have is what we call AGX Silver Sol, which is the first, I thought we had that here, which is the first non-toxic form of silver that has been patented and proven to reduce wound bioburden and has major ramifications on the removal and killing of MRSA and other superbugs. The PEMF technology is being used in federal veterans' homes, outpatient clinics in Minnesota and across the country with good success over the last 2 years. AGX Silver is currently being used in field operations in Iraq and Afghanistan for the past several years with astounding results. I have with me today patients who have been successfully treated using the formulary approach right here. And we're going to hear from our director of nursing on two other cases. Both of them were going to be here today, but for scheduling purposes could not be here. The proposal you have before you today in SF3277 brings us innovative wound prevention and cure formulary program to the Minnesota Veterans Home via a pay-for-performance program that replicates the program in our long-term care facilities. We will have some of the devices here for you to observe. I would like now to turn it over to Kathy King, our Director of Nursing.
Ms. King.
That's me.
Maybe Senator Erickson Ropes, you could, or there, Mr. Pittner steps back. I guess that's fine.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. King.
Chairman, I'll be brief. Essentially, if we look to my left on this board over here, this gentleman is a 53-year-old who actually has testified several times before committees up here on the Hill. And he unfortunately had his toe amputated and was in the process of working with a wound clinic in St. Paul. And what happened with him was that he wasn't satisfied that he was going to have his leg amputated. And so what he did was he paired up with Advanced Healing and was started on machine. There's three different companies. It wasn't this exact machine, but it does the same thing, twice a day for 30 minutes. Within a week, his surgeon gave him a week to try it. There was healing that was noted, and as you can see, from 6/23/2004 until 9/1/2004, that was the time it took to heal, and he didn't have to have his leg amputated. He was up testifying last week, and what he said to the committee that he testified before, that he was sure that he would not have had to have his toe amputated if he would have had this technology available to him before then. The second case here is a case that I'm very familiar with because it was in my facility. This woman was in an assisted living, 87 years old, and she weighed 87 pounds. She was entertaining a guest, making a pot roast, went to pull the pot roast out of the oven, fell backwards with the pot roast, ended up in the pan on her legs. She was in the Hennepin County Burn Unit for a period of time. Because of her slight weight, she was not a candidate to have skin grafts. And so therefore what happened was once they got to a certain point, they discharged her to the transitional care unit in a nursing home. And it actually took us 69 days using this technology and this technology to heal her so she could go home, and she now is once again at home living in her assisted living.
Thank you, Ms. King. Ms. Hafner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Mary Hafner. I'm Director of Quality Assurance for Elam Care Incorporated, which we provide services for seniors in three states, Iowa, Minnesota, and North Dakota. A year ago, from January 1/07 to July 07, we implemented this whole program, which is a whole formulary, under the direction of the medical director, Dr. Milkey, who is known in the metro area as a wound specialist. We were spending, having outrageous costs for wound care. Many of the residents we were receiving from the hospital had stage 3 and stage 4 wounds. We had diabetic wounds, surgical wounds, burns that we were not able to heal without tremendous costs. So our corporation, our president of our company, said, let's give this a try. We did implement the program with success. I've been with our organization now 7 years. Residents that I've known in some of the facilities that have had wounds as long as I've been with the company, we were able to heal leg ulcers, coccyx pressure ulcers that were 3-4 stage and that had tunneled with such success that our corporation has decided now that we are going to implement this program in all of our facilities. I'm a veteran of the U.S. Air Force Nurse Corps, so I'm very interested in the services that we provide not only to the veterans in our facilities, but to all the elderly residents that we care for. And I would recommend, I've seen such tremendous results. On January 18th, I myself had surgery, a minor foot surgery that ended up with an infection. 3.5 weeks ago today, my physician wanted to amputate my toe in order to heal the wound from my surgical incision. I begged him. I explained this procedure. He had me using the wound vac, which was very costly and not healing and was very painful. So I explained to him, and this technology is so new that he was not aware of it. And I explained to him that our corporation is using this. We've seen such great success. Would I be able to try it? Could you write an order for me to try this? He did write the order, and when I saw him last week, he said, I think we're going to be able to save the toll. And that was just in the matter of 2 weeks. So I'm a personal believer in it and recommend and have seen the results myself. I have home health care nurses coming out who are interested in it, and they're saying, that's a miracle. We cannot believe how your wound is healed. So I'm a strong advocate, both as a provider to our elderly that we serve and then as a recipient myself.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Erickson-Rope, is there somebody here from the commissioner's office that is going to talk on this?
Yes, the department's here to speak on that, and they will probably tell you that we don't have a runaway wound care problem in the nursing
homes.
Come on up.
Deputy Commissioner.
Deputy Commissioner. But they're not in opposition to the bill and are anxious to continue moving forward with this as long as everyone understands that we're going to continue to work on some of the language in the bill if that meets the committee's approval.
Well, and Senator, in committee, you know, let's hear from the commissioner. But from my point of view, you know, if this works and if it can help heal veterans' wounds, well, that's a good thing. But I really think that the Health and Human Services Committee is a more appropriate venue for that discussion than here. So we would move this to finance, and they would move it on to their deputy commissioner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gilbert Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner, Veterans Health. As Senator Erickson just mentioned, I'm not opposed to any system or any technology that's out there that will help our veterans heal. I would like to point out that we at the state of Minnesota have a lot going on with the veterans' homes at current, and I personally would not want to add more to the Minneapolis Veterans Home at this current time. However, I'd like to continue the dialogue with the company and perhaps look at some of our other veterans' homes that are stable and can benefit from this system. Absolutely. One of the things I'd like to point out, sir, is that, as an example, one of our veterans' homes, just one, in Laverne, Minnesota, has spent about $2,000 in 1 year in wound care. So we don't really have a major problem with wound issues, not to say that it won't be there. In long-term care, you never know. But I will say that we have a tremendous amount of work and good efforts in wound prevention.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. And Senator Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. One of the things that strikes me about this bill, and is there anything that would prevent you or your department or the homes under your supervision from contracting with this company or any other company to provide the kind of services that are being talked about here? Is there anything right now that would keep you from doing that if you wanted to do that or felt it was warranted?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at this present time, the only thing that I would say is that I would have to look at our budget to make sure that we can afford this within our budget structure. But other than that, no, sir. I would actually entertain the idea of looking at ways to improve our care.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hamm.
Commissioner, and I, the reason I'm asking is that it seems to me that I'm a little uncomfortable with us making a decision to implement something like this when we may not know the full extent of what other options might be out there or what other kinds of things that the department is or the is confronting. I think that if there's a question of agreeing to do something, then finding resources to pay for it, those are things that are typically addressed in a budget where people are putting together a budget and say we're going to try these things. But this is talked about as being a significant cost saving, too, so that if there were those cost savings, then you could argue that it would not have any negative budgetary impact. But my point is I'm just wondering why we would have to pass a law requiring it to be done if it's something that, if it makes sense, would be done anyway by the department. And I don't know if you want to comment on that, but I'm a little reluctant to pass this when there are things that we may not know about in terms of how it's to be done. And not to say that it isn't a good technology. That's not my point.
Senator Cornyn,
briefly. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Well, I would reiterate what I said. You know, I think even though this committee now is the policy and the budget division, in my mind, in when I focus on this in this committee right now, I try to decide in my mind if this is good, if we're setting forward good policy for our veterans. And as we have a lot of our veterans being involved with these explosions and maybe shrapnel and so on and so forth with wounds that you know are potentially could not be healing. You know, I think this is good technology, and I think it's good policy. And I would just say that I think the committee should move this out of here and move it over to the Finance Committee so it would be directed to Senator Berglund's committee, which would have more jurisdiction over this, really, and decide whether or not we can pay for this. And Senator Erickson Ropes and myself serve on that committee, and we'd certainly be willing to work with the commissioner to try to make it friendly to the department. And I just think it's a good policy, and I think we should move it out. And if Senator Erickson Ropes doesn't move it, I certainly will.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm kind of with Senator Hand on this. I just kind of wonder why the department can't just do it on their own if this is a good idea. And I do have a couple of questions. One is, what is the expected cost? What's this appropriation number likely to be? And then the other thing that kind of stuns me is that if an amputation costs $140,000, if that's the correct number, that seems almost unbelievable to me that it could be that much. Not that I want anybody to have their leg or hand or arm amputated, but just for the procedure, $140,000, that doesn't hardly sound believable to me.
Mr. Chair, my name is David Kunz. I am
Mr. Kunz.
Representing Advanced Healing Systems. We have data from the Veterans Administration on the PEMF technology. It is in a binder about this thick on that device, and in there the cost on those wounds for amputation runs them at $140,000 per amputation. In addition, they have additional costs if they have to provide prosthetics of over $100,000 additionally every 2 years. So we have a lot of documented information. The Department of Health also testified in their long-term care side of the healthcare delivery system, they were paying $140,000. That's what they estimate an amputation. And the legislature has been looking at a pay-for-performance type program, and that's what the purpose of this bill was, to change the way you look at healthcare and try and get results and pay for those results. The significant thing is if you put this per facility costs is about $25,000 per facility for a year. So you will get substantial savings. We have talked with the departments or the facilities prior to this year, and their budgets were such that they didn't have the money, and so they couldn't put the technology in. So we came forward with a paper performance type of proposal, and hope you'll consider it. It is a good value. We are not talking about millions of dollars of investment, and we certainly would like. We want to give the department the tools that they need, and if it takes $100,000 or $200,000. That's a budget committee if they can. They need the tools. So thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Erickson Ropes, and I appreciate the testimony. Commissioner, I guess going back to this point, it seems to me like what we're being asked to do here is engage in a contract with a particular company to provide a service. And typically, my understanding is that there's a competitive bid process where we evaluate different approaches to solve a problem, and then we have a public, have the department or the agency involved with making that decision to bring in different approaches, and they go through a request for a proposal, and then they make a decision. It's a little unusual in my relatively short experience here in the legislature for a legislative committee to circumvent that and say, well, we're going to pick this company to do this, even though it seems apparent that the department isn't coming and saying, we need to do this and we're looking for money to do it. They're saying we're not going to resist it, but they're not making the request. And so I don't know what the process is here, but I'm a little uncomfortable with our playing that role when we typically don't spend taxpayers' money and award it to a particular entity without going through some kind of competitive bidding process. And maybe there's no other company that can do this, or maybe the problem that they're dealing with can't be addressed any other way. But I just am uncomfortable with having a law that would direct public taxpayer dollars to a particular company to do something.
Senator Hahn, I think if you read online, page 1, line 10, it doesn't pick a company, but it does say a private sector entity.
And Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that, but the testimony is all here, and the documentation all here is from one company. So I look at this and I say, this is not a neutral presentation of a problem with a sort of a broad technique of how it's done. We're getting a pitch here for a particular solution that's provided by one company. And I'm not saying that that isn't the best approach or the best solution. I'm just questioning whether this committee in its purview should be making that decision when I think it should be part of a competitive bid process conducted by the department. And so I'm not saying anything about the technology. I don't know whether it's good, bad. I'm not an expert in any of that. It sounds very good, and I'm sure that it's been very productive. I do know Elam Care, the president of that company, is a friend of mine and is in my district, and I know that if they're thinking it's a good thing, it probably is. But I just question whether this committee ought to be doing this and circumventing what we would normally do when we're spending taxpayer money. That's my question.
Thank you. Senator Erickson Rope, do you have a motion?
I do. If you want to hear of a response to the concern?
I think Senator Erickson Rope were pretty well informed. We've got one more bill and six more minutes. So, Senator Erickson Rope, do you have a motion?
Senator Corey.
Mr. Chairman, I would so move that Senate File 3277 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Senator Corey, is that okay with the author? You are the author.
I'm an author on there, too.
Senator Coring moves that Senate File 3277 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. Any more discussion, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
I'm uncertain. All those in favor, raise your hand. All those opposed, raise your hand. The motion passes 5-4. Thank you, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, committee members. We'll keep
Senate
working on this.
File 3277 is passed and referred to the Finance Committee. And Senator Erickson Ropes, are you going to start Senate File 3633 for Senator Vickerman?
Well, it doesn't say so.
And Mr. Palmer and General Shelladol, would you please come up?
Say hello.
Providence Community Health Insurance District Litchfield has project on the project concerning Green Lake, I think it is.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Doing Senator Vickerman a favor since he's off with family events as well. So I'm here to welcome our two distinguished members, and they'll walk you through the bill.
General
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Larry Shalito. I'm the Adjutant General for the state of Minnesota. All of you should have received at an earlier presentation this book here. Just a quick update. The 148th out of Duluth is now flying home from Alaska. They will be the most long-deployed air wing in the United States Air Force in the year 2007. The 133rd is preparing to go to Afghanistan. The 34th Combat Aviation Brigade is preparing to leave in May to go to Afghanistan. The 2nd of the 147th Aviation Battalion, which had the one featured of the all-female flight on Christmas Day, is currently in Afghanistan. For our Vietnam vets in the room, they're doing battalion-level airlifts at night with night vision goggles. That is beyond graduate school. Two of the 135 out of the Mankato area is currently in Bosnia. If you monitored the AP, you would have seen a U.S. soldier standing facing a bunch of irate Serbians trying to cross the border. If you looked even more carefully, you would have seen the Red Bull patch. They were moved up to help reinforce the French sector. I'll leave it at that. The personnel and finance detachments are home. The two air wings were rated in the top 10% of all units in the United States Air Force. The finance was rated top two in the CENTCOM region in Afghanistan, even though they were not using the modern equipment that the active duty had. So that's the point I want to make. But most importantly, what we're going to talk about is how we continue to move these soldiers forward to include their family. We believe it to be a three-part, the service member, their family, and their employer. The reintegration program that you helped us support has now been approved on the national level. And there's a glitch in the funding, which we're trying to work out with the Department of Defense. But it is a national model referred to as the Minnesota model. And it's transcending not just the Army, but Army, Air, Marines, Navy, and so forth. So with that, Mr. Terry Palmer will present our specifics to this bill.
Thank you, General Schlottel, and I and the committee give you our thanks for all the Minnesota National Guard members that are serving our country. Mr. Palmer.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, staff, Terry Palmer, Comptroller for the Department of Military Affairs. I'm only going to speak on the provisions that relate to the Department of Military Affairs. The bill contains four budget initiatives that were previously announced by the governor. It's a total of $390,000 added funding in 2009. It also has an initiative dealing with revenue to the general fund at a cost of $100,000, and then one policy issue which has no cost to the department or the state. If you turn to page 4, I assume you have copies of the bill. We start section 5. There's a $75,000 appropriation in fiscal year 2009, which is to initiate a new program dealing with recognition of employers of the spouses of the military members of the National Guard. There's a federal program that recognizes employers of the military members, but this would be an add-on to that and would recognize employers who go over and above and beyond what is required of them in helping the service member's family deal with the deployments. There's also a $135,000 appropriation in fiscal year 2009, which deals with a bonus program for medics in the National Guard. If you look at the chart that was handed out, a picture of the state, it shows the relative density of Minnesota National Guard medical personnel throughout the state. What this program is intended to do is to encourage these members of the Guard to keep their certification. Unlike most other military occupational specialties, persons in this military specialty have to take additional
CEUs to maintain their certification. So over and above their normal drills and annual training periods, they're required to take additional training, which we're hoping to continue to encourage them to do that. There are 388 members of the Guard who hold this certification, and within the next 2 years, we potentially lose 300 of those 388, which would be a real disaster, I think, for the state of Minnesota and the National Guard. There's also an appropriation, recognition of appropriation for fiscal year 2010 and 11. There's language that deals with this. It's an expansion of the tuition reimbursement program whereby the spouses of members of the Guard who have not used their allotted credit hours would be able to use those, pass them on to their spouses as sort of another way to encourage those members to maintain their membership in the Guard. As the General spoke about how busy the Guard was, the Governor and the General visited troops all around the world, and these are those sorts of issues that they relayed to the Governor and to the Adjutant General about how it would be better for them to be able to maintain their membership in the Guard. And then if you turn to page 7 on section 7, there's a change in the Support Our Troops appropriation language that allows the Adjutant General to give grants to family readiness groups. These are groups that form all the time, but they get very active when the members of the Guard unit that they support are deployed. So it gives them a chance to have some small funds to do things relative to their spouse's deployment. Currently, they have to go out and beg money from various service groups, and it's very counterproductive because at a time when they're being required to spend more time taking care of the family or the home, they're out trying to raise money to do these things. So we think this is a great idea. It doesn't cost anything. There's also a provision on page 8, section 9, that deals with the management of the timber lands at Camp Ripley. What this does is allows the Adjutant General to retain the revenue generated from the sale of timber at Camp Ripley. The DNR manages the forest land in a manner which is not necessarily the best for military training purposes. They look at a high, rapid growth, fiber-rich environment where the National Guard would prefer something a little bit more stable. And when they sell timber, the contractors come in and cut the trees off, leave the stumps in place, which creates some additional problems for the Minnesota Guard relative to taking care of that land so it can be used for training. That's a net loss of $100,000 as the Department of Finance has calculated it. There's also the language for the State Enhanced Employer Support of the Guard program that we already talked about. And then the Medic Recertification Bonus Program language is there. And then on page 10 is the language for the textbook and tuition reimbursement grant program for spouses that we had previously talked about, too. Subject to your questions, Mr. Chair, that's my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Questions, members? Deputy Commissioner Puglisi. Thank you, Mr. Palmer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Veterans Affairs. I will be presenting our supplemental budget requests. I know time is of the essence, so I will whip through it as quickly as possible and take any questions that you might have along the way. Everybody should have received in their packet a handout that you can use to follow along. First request is for the State Soldiers Assistance Program. It's a base adjustment increase of $2 million. Request is ongoing from the general fund. Our request is for one-time adjustment of $500,000 to cover our potential shortfall here in this fiscal year. The program has been very successful. It's being used quite a bit throughout the state, and we think we're going to have a shortfall. It's been helping veterans since 1944 in very meaningful ways. It's a very responsive program. It helps fill the gaps at the federal level, and it's usually in the forms of an emergent need to help keep people in their homes, put food on the table until they can get back to employment. The next page is seeking base funding of $220,000.
What page are you on, Deputy?
I'm on page 3 right now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Linkvet line funding. We're seeking base funding of $220,000. The request is ongoing from the general fund. This initiative seeks funding to continue the operation of the 24-hour referral crisis toll-free phone line. We began this program last year with no state money. We've got the software for free. We used existing staff. It's been very successful. In just a few months, we've had over 2,500 contacts with this. We'd like to keep this as a permanent program within our department, so we're seeking some funding to do that. Page 4, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, outreach and education. We're all aware of the issues with post-traumatic stress disorder and the increased issues with traumatic brain injuries. What we're seeking is one-time funding of $200,000. The request is from the general fund. This initiative seeks funding to promote existing post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury programs for returning veterans. We want to promote screening for PTSD and TBI at the federal level. We're already doing a lot of that throughout the reintegration efforts that the Guard is putting forward. We'd like to do a follow-up study considering future mental health needs of returning guardsmen and veterans with PTSD and TBI. We did a small study last year which showed that there is a need to increase the services throughout the state. We want to take that a step further and look at how we can implement those changes. Next page, page 5, Link Vet Phase 2 Veteran Case Managers. As a result of implementing the linkage line, we quickly realized that many of the veterans and the family members using that service have multiple needs. They're not just calling with one or two needs that they can be referred somewhere. They're calling with 5, 6, 7 issues that truly require a case management approach to ensure that we're getting meaningful help to them. We'd like to expand that service to include case managers for those veterans and family members that need more in-depth, more intense follow-up and care. Page 6, State Veterans Cemetery. You heard a little bit about that today. What we're seeking is base funding for 2010-2011 in the amount of $325,000. That includes $75,000 for our existing cemetery in Little Falls to continue the operations and maintenance of that facility. The remainder of $325,000 would be used to support the new cemetery that's going to be placed up there in Duluth. Page 7, Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. We're seeking a base adjustment increase of $250,000 for MACV. That is our homeless program here in Minnesota for veterans. They do a tremendous job. We've partnered with them for many years. They have statewide presence, and they do a tremendous job for our homeless veterans. But unfortunately, the money that they receive from grants from the state, from the federal, from the private sector, and they leverage all of those grants, falls short of being able to provide meaningful care for our homeless veterans. So we'd like to see them get some more money. Page 8, State Navigator. This is a joint effort between Military Affairs and the Department of Veterans Affairs. We'd like to be able to make it a little bit better transition from warrior to veteran. So what we're proposing is $120,000 to create these positions. There'll be shared positions, make the transition a little bit more seamless, also help coordinate the efforts from the public sector and the private sector. There's a lot of people out in the community and a lot of organizations that want to do good things for our veterans. We don't have anybody that can coordinate those efforts. We'd really like to coordinate those efforts and provide them in the community where these veterans are residing. I think it's the way to go, and I think we can save a lot of money in doing that. Page 9, Veterans Claims Office. We have claims officers that represent veterans for obtaining their federal benefits. We have a claims office up in Fargo. We have one at the Fort Snelling federal building as well. We bring in about $18 million of federal benefits per month, and we do that, and we're only spending about $600,000, $700,000 a year on staff. So it's a great return on investment. Our caseload has increased 46% in the past year. We just cannot keep up with the demand, and if we're not able to do an adequate job of the representation, federal benefits are missed and lost. The mistakes that are made at the federal level on these claims are not discovered. When we have the time to really dig into these claims and pursue them well, we find a lot of errors that sometimes go back to the 40s. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars in retroactive benefits for our veterans. And the more time we have to look at them and focus on these claims, the more federal benefits we can leverage and bring back here for our veterans. So it's definitely a very good program, very worthwhile. We're looking for $250,000 extra to add some more staff. One of those staff positions would be a female veteran service coordinator. We have a lot of female veterans returning that have combat experience now. There's a lot of unique issues that they're facing as well. And many times they want to deal with another female because they're sensitive issues. We'd like to have a female presence in our office so that we can do that for them. Next page, number 10, County Veteran Service Officer grants to counties and CVSO training coordinators. We introduced an enhancement grant for CVSOs a couple of years ago. It's been very successful. They're all, for the most part, using it, but there's not enough money to go around to all 87 counties. It's an opening competitive grant process. We've been very pleased with how they've been coming forward to use it, quite creative. We'd like to increase that amount so that we can provide more assistance in the counties so that they can do more with providing services to the veterans within their counties. We'd also like to, and that's $500,000. $250,000 of the $750,000 would be for training coordinators. Statutorily, we're required to provide ongoing training and education of the county veteran service officers. Unfortunately, we've never received any type of financial support or staff to do that, so we use existing funds and existing staff to do that. Education of our CVSOs is paramount if they're going to be successful in their mission, so what we'd like to do is actually get some money so that we can do a better job of educating them on what they should be doing out there in the counties. Next page, page 11. We'd like a base adjustment increase of $715,000 ongoing from the general fund to increase, actually double the number of our campus reps from 12 to 24. It's been a very successful program. Many of the returning veterans are using this program. We have a website as well, mymilitaryeducation.org, which gets a lot of hits. There's been 3,500 unique contacts made since the start of this program, and they do more than just help the veterans and their family members navigate through the education benefits. They're also a referral service, outreach service, and they've done a tremendous job. We'd like to increase that presence throughout the state. Right now, we only have 12, and it's a pretty big state. We'd like to double that. Page 12, Veterans Affairs Marketing. We've testified many times that only about 40% of veterans receive their federal and state benefits. Part of the problem is they're just not aware. Through the linkage line, with all the calls we get, one of the questions we ask, are you aware that you have a CVSO in your county? Majority of the callers say, no, I didn't even know that. So one of the things we need to do more of is market the CVSOs, the Link Vet line, the state veterans benefits, the federal programs. So we're seeking a $100,000 base adjustment of ongoing funding from the general fund so we could do more marketing in this area. Page 13, and I believe that's the last page. Veterans Home, and I'll let Deputy Commissioner Gil Acevedo take that.
Deputy Commissioner Acevedo.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner, Veterans Homes and Veterans Healthcare. We're seeking a one-time funding of $200,000. This request is from the general fund. It's a one-time request. It's to do strategic planning and planning for the Veterans Home, and since the Veterans Home has just recently been put under the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. We're looking at ways to improve our operation, also look statewide to see the proper usage of the Veterans Homes and future homes throughout the state. So we want to have a study to make sure that we're looking at the places that were for future Veterans Homes, as well as our current operations to make sure that we're providing the proper care to our veterans.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioners. And members, we're going to lay over Senate File 36. 33, but do we have any questions? I know. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious when the last strategic plan was completed.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is an uncertain question. I don't have an answer to that, sir. I have studied and looked in the time that I've been here. There's been different types of attempts to conduct a strategic plan, but to this date, there really is no strategic plan that I can put my finger on.
Thank you. Senator Scogin.
Just, and then one other question to the other testifier. You know, in a time of financial difficulty, I'm just looking at the Link Vet 2, and the state navigation, and I just want to make sure that we're not duplicating services within these three groups. There's almost $1 million there, and I want to make sure that they each are doing a specific job.
Deputy Commissioner Puglisi.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's a good question, and you know, we've looked at that very closely to make sure that there's not a duplication. Sometimes there's a little bit of a crossover, a pass-off from one to the other. With the case managers, the Link Line Vet is only a referral service, 24-7 with crisis intervention. So when the veterans or the family members call, we refer them to the appropriate place. If it's the VA Medical Center or back to their county veteran service officer, we do a soft transfer on the phone. We connect with the person, say, hey, we have so-and-so on the line. They're looking for help on this. Then we transfer the call. Also, 24-7 crisis intervention. But as a result of that, we've noticed a lot of the callers can't just be passed off to somebody. There's so many needs that they have that we need to really implement a case management approach to ensure that all of their issues are being taken care of so they don't fall through the cracks and show up at our door another year later.
And committee members, we're going to go to Senator Ingebitz in a minute, but this we're going to see this again. We just wanted to get it out, get the hearing today so that everybody had a chance to review it, and we'll see this again for more questions. But Senator Ingebitz?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Page number 8, State Navigators, you said $120,000 request. How many FTEs do you have, say, for a team of people? How many FTEs are you talking about?
Looks like a pretty good bang for the buck.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, $120,000 is Department of Veterans Affairs portion. Military Affairs is going to be asking for a request of $160,000. It's a 60-40 split. 60% of the time right now is with the Military Affairs, 40% for Department of Veterans Affairs. As we change and shift the reintegration program, as hopefully the war ends, it will then change to a 60-40 split, Department of Veterans Affairs 60, Military Affairs 40%. So we're looking at actually $280,000. We're looking to have one person at the top to reach out and then two support staff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioners. And I think with that, the Chair will lay Senate file 3633 over. And that's all the work before the committee today. Thank you, members. Committee's adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.